We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is hour number two of Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour, we're doing something a little unusual, a little out of the ordinary. We're going to broadcast a show that we recorded last week at the Illini Union Bookstore as part of the store's Off the Page Summer Book Festival. I sat down last Tuesday with two guys who spent a lot of time being involved in Illinois politics as observers and participants, Jim Nolan and Rick Winkle. They're both affiliated with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Both have served in the legislature, and they are the co-authors of a recent book, Illinois Politics, A Citizen's Guide, that's published by the University of Illinois Press. And we talked about a number of things, the state's financial crisis, about ethical reform, this year's race for governor, and we hope that you'll enjoy listening to this conversation. And as you listen, do keep in mind that in this hour, we will not be taking calls. What I thought we would do is I would invite Jim and Rick to talk a little bit about the state of the state. And I think everyone knows that it is not good. Just recently, for example, the controller, Dan Hines, he released his final financial report for the fiscal year just ended, and he said, and I quote, "Illinois ended the year in its worst fiscal position in its history. We're doing better, worse, than we were doing in the Depression." And I want to start there and have you both talk a little bit about what exactly that means. Where are we now? And maybe Rick will start.
Well, David, we called the book Illinois Politics for a reason. We could have called it Government and Politics, but there's very little government to talk about. Politics has usurped the public square and become the issue. It's the driving force, but it's an odd thing. The more politics becomes involved, the less political will there is among leadership to deal with problems. Problems that involve the budget, the fiscal health of the state, and the biggest issue that's facing the state of Illinois, and it's because of our politics and lack of political will, is a structural deficit. You know, and this has not happened overnight. We've had our expenditures outrun our revenues year after year after year, and the day of reckoning in the middle of a great recession has finally come, and we're $13 billion in the hole. So it's going to take stellar leadership, political will to get a grip on this and undo this decline that we've experienced into this deep pit of debt and structural deficit. It's going to take years, and it's going to take a committed, decisive leadership. And I think the biggest issue that's facing the state of Illinois right now is the political will. Where are the leaders that we need that recognize a problem and are willing to decisively address those and turn this budget problem around? Any agency, including the University of Illinois, that's dependent on state dollars certainly knows the acute problem.
Well, Jim, we have this enormous problem. We have a $13 billion deficit. We have problems of long standing. So this is not something that just started. So for those people who would be tempted to say, this is really about the downturn in the national economy, is this really actually about how things run in Springfield?
Well, clearly the national economy has exacerbated the situation, but if you look at the Comptroller's comprehensive annual fiscal report, you'll see that the net assets of the state have been declining by about $3 billion a year since the year 2000. So clearly the problem has been building from long before the recession hit. I might note that the Depression of the 1930s was probably a worse time than we are facing at the moment. Clearly, it was a momentous time that resulted in momentous change. The state property tax was eliminated and replaced by a sales tax. So I just use that illustration of the Depression to show that in the grips of a grievous situation, there there was the leadership to of necessity to make significant change. I mean, the situation was so bad then that scrip was being issued to teachers in lieu of real money to get them along until the situation stabilized a bit. It'll be interesting to see if we, as Rick says, have the will to make momentous change to deal with the present situation.
Well, I was really struck by a line in the book. One of the things that the book deals with is the political culture in the state. And I was really struck by this line early on in the book where you write, Illinois has been captive to a political culture that treats government as just another marketplace to do business, providing a fertile setting for corruption. That's a pretty strong statement.
I think it's a very accurate statement, unfortunately. It's you know, we have a culture of corruption in the state of Illinois. There's no getting around it. You can look at the numbers. Look at the U.S. Attorney's Office, for instance, the successful prosecutions in the past decade, over 400 successful prosecutions of public officials, state and local, in the Northern District of Illinois. That's astounding. That's number one. We lead the country in that. We're right there with New Jersey and Louisiana, you know, kind of the unholy trinity. It's not a good situation. It's something that all of us as citizens of this state have to come to grips with. We have to decide whether or not we want to tolerate business as usual, whether there's an expectation that, oh, this is the way things are done in Illinois, mm-hmm. that's somehow okay. You've certainly heard that as a defense. George Ryan used it as a defense, you know, it's always been done this way. And that's not a successful legal defense, nor is it a good way to run a political culture in any sense. We as a people have to be committed to effect some change and insist and expect more from our elected officials.
Yeah. I guess one of the things that I was really struck by and rather disappointed with was a lot of the reaction to the charges of misconduct leveled against former Governor Blagojevich, that so many people, their reaction was, oh, well, this is Illinois, as if this was just, as political corruption at that level was just something that was very common, had been going along for a long time. That's just the way politics are in Illinois.
And I think we've grown up to be unwittingly, maybe, complicit in this culture of corruption. I give an exercise to my students at the beginning of each course I teach in which I basically ask them to play the role of a younger sibling to a young man who's been charged with a DUI and who must, who's been charged with a serious DUI. He needs a driver's license for his first job out of college, and his wife, young wife, is at home with their first child, and he is told by his savvy lawyer that with $1,000 in cash in addition to the lawyer's fee, the lawyer believes that he can get the DUI dismissed because he understands the system. And the question to the younger sibling in the class, anonymous, of course, is that of should he go for it or reject it. And I've done this in seven different classes, and in every one it's been at least two out of three of the young students, mostly seniors headed for law school, who say go for it. So there is something kind of that is inculcated within us as a state society that suggests it's the way it's always been done. And if I, you know, I'm foolish not to try something that might be to my benefit, even though it might besmirch the judicial system in this instance.
Do you think that political corruption in Illinois is any worse than other states? Louisiana is sometimes mentioned, New York is sometimes mentioned, other places.
The numbers are pretty clear that we're certainly ranking way, way up there as far as successful convictions. If you just look at convictions of public officials, Illinois leads the way, and it's unfortunate. I mean, the numbers are very clear. You know, your question about Rod Blagojevich and the charges against him, I guess I would say just as the Great Recession we're experiencing now has laid bare how bad the fiscal situation is in Illinois, what Rod Blagojevich is alleged to have done, and I believe he will be successfully convicted of doing, would make George Ryan blush. That it is It is, as Patrick Fitzgerald, the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, said, it's corruption on steroids. So it's a whole new level. And it's an arrogance and a, in some ways, it's an opportunity, though, for us to recognize that this is a time to really seriously examine ourselves as a state and what we expect of ourselves and those who we elect as representatives, and to demand more. And it's not going to be just simply a matter of passing some legislation and enacting reforms, as important as those are. It's going to have to actually come within each and every one of us, and individually and collectively, to demand more of our elected officials. We have to come to grips. Yes, we do have a problem, and we are unique in that regard, unfortunately, in the country.
Mm. Well, I know that part of the purpose of the book, I think, is to familiarize people with the structure of politics right. in Illinois. And there's a lot of practical kinds of information here. Going to the issue of the financial crisis that we've talked about, $13 billion deficit, the state's year-end general revenue fund balance was a negative $4.69 billion. The governor has talked about making some cuts, but how meaningful those are is certainly a proverbial drop in the bucket. At the same time, I think everyone's expecting now really that we're just going to limp along. We're going to limp along until the election. We'll see what happens there. We may have a new governor and we may not. Maybe we'll come to grips with this next year. Why is it that even though we know there's a very serious problem here, is there something about the structure or the fact of Illinois politics that makes it difficult to really seize hold of the problem and try to deal with it?
Well, the practical structure of the moment is the election itself and the unwillingness of the legislators and the leadership to deal with the problem prior to the all-important 2010 election, which precedes the redistricting of lines for the legislative and congressional districts, and thus the importance of being in the majority there, which gets back to Rick's point about how politics trumps government in this game, and it probably goes back to the political culture to some extent. That is, many of the society have seen government, as we say, as a place to do business, and as a place to do business, it becomes also a place to develop careers, and we have developed a kind of careerist orientation in the governmental political system that means that comes first prior to solving public policy problems. I do think that in the spring there will be significant action to address the problem simply because of the fact that the bond ratings of the state of Illinois are now just below those of Iraq in terms of quality. So something will have to be done.
Do you think, Rick, that something will be done?
Well, it's a function of re-election. There's no doubt about that. I agree with Jim's observation about careerism as a real factor here. Every state representative is up for re-election. 20 out of the 59 state senators, just by their structure, are up for re-election. What's their choices? They can cut spending and run as Scrooge. That's how they look at it. Am I going to get reelected if I cut programs that we're going to hear about when I get back home? Am I going to raise taxes? Well, that's not too popular either. So, am I going to borrow to try to get through? Am I going to increase gaming? What are we going to do? And we ended up doing nothing, despite the gigantic debt, the fiscal hole, which are different things, but the debt is increasing as we borrow and take on longer-term debt, but also the immediate structural deficit problem and unpaid bills totaling $13 billion. We have actually taken no steps to deal with that. We've simply, it goes back to structure. The rank and file, which, I was among the rank and file. You read my bio. That's right. I was there, too. I can tell you that what's happened over the years, there's been an acquiescence in the rank and file to the leaders and allowing the leaders to have the driving decision-making in the budget process. But what's really absurd about this year is that even the leaders now, the legislative leaders, have said, no, thanks for the authority, the power you've concentrated in our hands, but we're going to give this to the governor. Let's let the governor. We're not going to have line item budget. We're not going to say how, as normally we would, with appropriations, with lines as to how money would be allocated for different services and programs. No, we're going to do a lump sum budget to give the governor authority to reallocate it as he sees fit, to make cuts, it's unprecedented. Mm-hmm. Now, whether the governor will actually take the bull by the horns and do some of this fiscal management himself, but what's happened is you've had members kicking it up to legislative leaders who now have kicked it up to the governor. Nobody wants to handle this budgetary hot potato, and it's a lack of political will. It's a lack of courage to deal with the very tough issues.
Just one technical question here, Jim. Doesn't the Illinois State Constitution require the legislature to present the governor a balanced budget?
Yes, clearly the situation is unconstitutional, but it's not likely that the court is going to it hasn't been asked to address the situation, mm-hmm. number one, and it would be wary of, I think, intruding on the legislature and executive.
You know, it's hard to think about this in today's terms. In the past, when we talked about this, yeah, I mean, there's a balanced budget requirement in the Illinois Constitution. Well, these are based on estimates, your best estimates of what the revenues are, your best estimates, good faith best estimates of what the revenues and expenditures are. And, you know, I remember Governor Edgar used to really seriously underestimate what the revenues were. He was in a tough economic and fiscal situation, so he was trying to balance the budget, saying no to expansion of programs and underestimating revenues, hoping the economy would grow and there'd be jobs, people paying income taxes, buying goods, sales taxes, revenues, which eventually that did happen. Eventually, because of fiscal management and fiscal restraint, we were able to seize that opportunity. But in this case, where the budget actually has been rendered meaningless. There's no line items. The authority is just ambiguous. So, I mean, as somebody said in the administration, I thought it was a great line. I'll steal it. Appropriations are great.
It's part of the political corruption.
Yeah. Yes, yes. I'm sorry you've caught me, but appropriations are terrific. They're great. Cash is better.
Yeah. Right at the moment, as I'm sure everybody knows, the legislature is controlled by the Democrats. The governor's a Democrat. Now, when you and Sam first wrote this book, first version of this back in 1969, I think
you... Whigs and Tories.
Not quite that far back. Back in those days, the GOP had control, so it's gone back and forth. The reason I raise the question here is that it seems to me for some time now, when we've come around to time for an election, there have been actually very few seats that are actually in contention. It seems to me we've got an awful lot of safe seats, and that probably has something to do with this strange way we draw the legislative districts every 10 years. Is that a part of the problem, that we don't get a lot of change because there's really very little turnover in the state house?
And the districts are drawn to be safe for either the Republicans or the Democrats, and that tends to give the holders of those seats a sense of security in most election cycles that they can operate from their respective conservative or liberal perspectives and not feel a need to compromise because they can be reelected with their conservative or liberal base. And mm-hmm. So it is different from when I was a legislator and there were three members elected from each House district, a rough form of proportional representation. And the result of that situation was that there tended to be members who were elected without regard to the party leadership and thus could be somewhat independent of it. And thus, when the income tax was enacted back in 1969, there were many legislators among those voting in the majority who felt that they could have that they were willing to do so because they were I was going to say independent of party, but both parties did indeed support the income tax increase that time around.
And the person who was responsible for leading the effort to reduce the size of the legislature and a lot of people think that maybe was not such a good thing, was a fellow named Pat Quinn.
That's right.
Who happens not to be the governor.
Well, it created single-member districts. I mean, the basic theory was you reduce the size of the House by a third, you're going to save a lot of money. As we can see, that's clearly not the case. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, so that part didn't work. But what I think what's actually a little below the surface, which I think is even more important, is that it created single-member districts. And single-member districts allowed, or once the leaders, the legislative leaders, realized what they had, is that they could target races. Yes, there are a few that are actually in contention, but those that are in contention, they could target and zero in on those and raise money with lobbyists, et cetera, and zero in on those races. I'm speaking from personal recollection on this. I've always had what they call a swing district in the sense it could swing Republican or Democrat every time. That shows how smart I am, right? So, I mean, it was always in contention. It was always targeted. It was always, there's always a great deal of money. And what that does then is it empowers leaders because members become, except for me, of course, but members become beholden to leaders. And because, you know, at the next election, they may be targeted, they may need funds, they can't raise it all themselves, they're going to go to their leaders for help. And that's helped consolidate power in the leadership over the past 20, 30 years.
And the leadership this time around has made it crystal clear within the legislative process that it was not interested in acting on the problem. I had a Republican legislator tell me on pain of death that his name not be issued, that he and eight other Republican legislators, through one of their fellow Republicans, went to Speaker Madigan to say that they would be willing to vote for an income tax increase this past spring. Mm-hmm. But Madigan said he wasn't interested.
Right.
Again, waiting until after the election.
Well, I would differ with Jim on one thing though. I'm not convinced that this will not be welcome news. But in the spring, it still remains to be seen. It really will be determined by the election. In fact, what I would submit is that this election, in some ways, is a referendum as to our future as a state. I mean, you know, are you going to re-elect Governor Pat Quinn, who's committed to increasing the income tax, or Bill Brady, who is the Republican candidate, who's going to run strictly and solve the problems on austerity programs and refuses to acknowledge the need to increase the income tax? So is it, which way are we going to go? And I would tell you that I think Jim is right, that there is, you can certainly see it in the state Senate, on the Democrat side at least, in the state Senate. Remember last spring, in 2009, the Senate passed an income tax increase. And it went over to the House. And, of course, that gets to Jim's point. That bill went nowhere because the Republicans stayed united and said, no, not until we see, you know, cuts in spending, austerity programs put in place, and we know exactly where the money is going that is going to be spent, unless until there's a deal, we're not going to put any votes on it. They wouldn't put any support on it. Madigan refused to go it alone, as they had in the Senate. Not all Democrats are going to pass the income tax increase. And so that died. So I guess with this referendum notion, if Pat Quinn is elected, yeah, I think maybe in January they'll be looking at an income tax increase. If he's not, and Bill Brady wins, I'm not so sure that anything really will happen, at least in the short term.
I think you may be right there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. For the benefit of people listening, maybe I should just reintroduce the guests, Rick Winkle and Jim Nolan. Rick is director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, Office of Public Leadership and Public Affairs. He's an adjunct professor of law at the U of I. He's served in the Illinois State Senate and in the House. Jim is a senior fellow at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, also adjunct professor of public policy at Knox College, and he's also been in the Illinois House. They are the co-authors, along with Sam Gove, of the book Illinois Politics, A Citizen's Guide, which is published by the University of Illinois Press. When Pat Quinn took office, he appointed a commission to study and come up with some recommendations for reform, political reform. They did that in about 3 months. It was a very distinguished panel of individuals and came up with a number of recommendations. What happened to that panel and its recommendations?
Well, I think you're referring to the reform panel. I was a member of another panel related to the tax and budget accountability.
I was thinking about the Governor's Reform Commission, and Patrick Collins was the chairman, and it had a number of people who've been around Illinois politics for a long time. They made a series of recommendations, which pretty much went nowhere. Should one be surprised that that had happened?
No, I don't think so. There wasn't to get back to Rick's concern about how there will have to be a kind of from within sense of outrage. Such didn't occur, really, at least not enough to worry the legislators, who, again, look at this as a professional calling, and that the reforms related to campaign contributions could clearly affect the leadership adversely if they had been adopted as recommended by Patrick Collins, and the Speaker of the House was not willing to give up his authority to make contributions without limitation. Rick, probably a better student of this than I am.
No, Jim, you're right. I mean, that's what it's. It gets back to the political thinking. It's strategic thinking. It's not trying to actually look to the public good and change for the betterment of the state. No, it's rather it's defensive in mode. It's strategic, and the idea here was, okay, we know that with the impeachment and federal prosecution of a governor, we've got to do something. Was kind of the attitude. Governor formed a commission. Sure, they came back with the recommendations, but we're not going to adopt all these because, gosh, that would change everything. So we're going to adopt some campaign finance changes, some limitations on contributions, and we're gonna because we believe in disclosure, we're going to make sure everybody has to report. Now, those reporting things went into effect July 1st. Interestingly, I mean, part of showing you the strategic nature of this decision, none of these campaign contribution limits are in effect now and will not be until January. Mm-hmm. I mean, why would that be, I wonder? You know, so it remains to be seen how they will be. You know, you can have limitations, which these are pretty, you know, these are not very stringent limitations, but they are a start. It's the first time in Illinois that we've had any sort of a limitation. So at least, I mean, from a reformer's point of view, that's progress of some sort. But it remains to be seen how strictly they'll be enforced, whether the State Board of Elections will be provided with the funding that's required to actually monitor, and whether there's going to be prosecutions, vigorous prosecutions for violations. We don't know yet, so we'll have to see.
And that's, I think it's worth underscoring the point that the reforms that we got, and I think it should be said, yes, forever, there had been no limits on contributions. So now we have limits on individuals and their contributions, but the leaders in the parties can still spend as much money as they want. So they didn't lose any party. It's just any influence.
Anything, it amplifies. That's the irony of this. It not only are they exempted out, but that exemption amplifies their power, mm-hmm. because now they really are the go-to people if you're going to influence the system. You give to the leadership because they can still funnel the money out. Otherwise, if you're an individual looking for these kind of contributions, there's limitations as to what you can do.
Just to go back to something we were talking about before, and this again goes to maybe something about the structure of Illinois politics. How important is the fact that we do indeed, the governor has a lot of power, but so do the legislative leaders. So we really have five individuals who have extraordinary power. You know, there's the old joke about how they go into a room and they decide what's going to happen, and then they come out and they present it to the members and they get to vote, but that they don't really have a great deal of say. How important is that in establishing the character of Illinois politics, do you think?
Well, I think this concentration of power among the legislators has developed since I was a legislator, lo, those many years ago, and it came about as a result of both the capacity of the decision of the legislative leaders to play a larger role in campaign finance. They created their own committees, which became more convenient places to make contributions by the major interests than individual legislators. And then second, in the early 80s, the leadership under Madigan and backed up later by Daniels decided to change the rules in such a way as to give the leaders dramatic power to replace members of committees for single votes only, to really control the flow of legislation much more totally or completely than was the case when I was a legislator. The irony of all this is that we have provided, the leaders have provided themselves, and the membership has gone along with this power to the leadership. And so the leaders have the capacity to act. Maybe Lem Madigan didn't have the capacity to bring enough votes along this spring, but the power brings with it capacity to act. And so the interesting thing is, in my mind, whether that capacity will be exercised next spring. Rick's point is that if Brady is elected governor, the Democrats are not likely to give him something that he could then veto, and so that may delay significant action for a year or more. And then I would add to all of this mix, we may be going through something that's larger than the focus of this book, and that is a societal rethinking of the social contract and what it is that government should and should not do, and what we can afford and not afford to do. I bring that up because when I was a legislator contemplating the income tax, there didn't seem to be such a strong anti-government mood among the public. And indeed, we provided more than enough votes to pass the income tax on the first try. Whereas I think today, maybe because of the dramatic deficits that we're incurring at the national as well as at the state level, and an anxiety out there among folks that they're not doing so well as they had hoped and not doing so well as their parents before them, that government becomes kind of the culprit for this. And thus, those of us who are affiliated with this university and other governmental functions are put on the defensive. And so it's an interesting additional dynamic that may be at play here, making it more difficult for political actors to make decisions.
I just real quick want to say to people who are listening, if you would like to ask a question and make a comment, we'd be happy to get you involved in the conversation. I'd be really pleased to.
This is a good crowd. Well,
hear from the crowd.
A lot of experienced people in this crowd.
And we have a microphone, so if somebody wants to give us a wave, and maybe we have somebody up here in front, we'd like to get in as many questions as we possibly can.
You're talking about a state income tax. What kind of a tax would it be to get this anywhere near manageable? Say we're going to retire this in 10 years. What kind of a tax, how much would it have to be?
You have a thought about that, right?
Well, I think you hit on a key point, that this is not a one-year solution. It's a multiple-year solution. I would suggest that it really does matter how you approach it. From my point of view, and my bias, probably a more fiscal conservative Republican bent, is that we need to make sure we have spending under control. We need to make sure that we don't expand programs in the face of a deficit. So austerity needs to be there. We need to pay our bills and pay those down systematically over time. They're almost $7 billion in arrears at this point, which is outrageous, and the delay in payment is extreme. So those things have to be taken care of, in my opinion, first. Then you look at the idea that perhaps if that doesn't close a gap, which I would submit, it probably will not. And so you have to be open to the idea, at least, of exploring what the taxes would be, which gets to your question. The income tax, we have to be careful. You raise the income tax, you drive business out of the state. Businesses move. Income can be relocated. Income generating corporations, individuals, they can be relocated to avoid a tax. But you have to explore the idea of maybe the income tax as an increase, but also perhaps broadening the base of the sales tax. For those who saw my 1994 campaign, you probably can't believe I'm saying this, but over the years I've become convinced that we have to broaden the base, maybe go into some of the services that's being considered, you know, a broader based sales tax, because services are where the growth in the economy is occurring. So maybe some combination of income tax increase and maybe sales tax with the additional services as a combination. But if you don't have the austerity program in place, first of all, the taxpayers will revolt because they don't want to pay more taxes only to see it spent and have the structural deficit occur again. They want to know that we have this firmly in hand and that we have policies that are very clear and enforceable that we prevent this kind of overspending that we've engaged in over the years.
Rick brings up an interesting point, and then I'll also try to respond to the tax point, and that is that we have what our fellow economist Fred Gertz calls a structural deficit. That is, the rate of increase in spending is going up, let us say, at 4% a year, and the rate of increase in revenue is going up at 3%. And thus, even if we increased a revenue source but continued to spend at a higher rate than we were generating revenue, we'd continue to have this structural deficit, and we'd end up back with the same problem that we have in a few years. So we have to figure out if we have the capacity to bend the curve, as they say, of the spending, which basically, I think, focuses us on the Medicaid program of health care to the low-income and middle-income nursing home patients, and we haven't figured out how to do that as yet. Anyway, that's another discussion.
I think we have somebody over here also had a question for us.
A question. After the election is over, there will be a veto session, and I think the governor can also call the legislature into special session if he chooses to. Do you anticipate any dynamic possibilities in that area after the election itself, the outcome of the election is known?
Depends on who wins. If it's Pat Quinn, you could see a veto session. I don't think I seriously doubt that a special session will be called between now and then. I just don't think the votes are there. I don't think there's a consensus as to what needs to be done. Although I disagree with that, I think that's the reality. So the political will that seems to be so sorely lacking at this stage may suddenly develop in the fall veto session if Quinn is elected. If Bill Brady's elected, I seriously doubt that would much would change in the veto session, and I have my doubts about the spring session that follows as well.
We have somebody who has another question here. Just real quick, if I could ask, I think that there are a lot of people in the state who would resonate with this idea that we've got to get spending under control. But I wonder whether you think that this election would likely turn on the question of whether, in addition to that, a tax increase is required, the additional revenue question.
I think that's right. I think I've probably simplified it in my referendum idea. It's not just about the income tax. It really is about committed leadership and getting spending under control. The anger that I sense in the electorate right now, if you look at some of the polling, what's interesting nationally, and like Jim was saying, if you look, you know, larger, if some of the larger polling, terrorism is still right up there as a threat, and so is debt. It's competing now with terrorism, with the attention of the electorate. That regardless, fewer and fewer people are buying into the notion that government spending creates jobs. And so I think you have to figure that into it as well. I think people are angry, and it's going to be interesting to see, you know, there's going to be a tremendous anti-incumbency mood. I've heard many people say, and I don't subscribe to this because I think you need to think individually about each person running on his or her own merits. But a lot of people said, I don't care who the incumbent is, Republican or Democrat, I'm voting against that person. That's a sense of frustration and anger right now, I think, that's out there.
Yeah. Well, we have another question here.
I'm not sure how to fit this into the political calculus, but if I were a tactician trying to decide what to do with a very difficult vote, I would try to solve as many of the problems of the state as I could with one tough vote. So far, we've talked about getting us even with current expenditures. Most folks understand there is a significant long-term budget problem with the retirement system. And the legislature, to the best of my recollection, has twice had the courage to come put together a 10-year plan, severely backloaded, and when the 10th year arrived, they changed the law again. So even if we solve today's problem, there is a huge, significant, let's say it that way, fiscal problem that obligations to current employees, not new, current employees, the state's going to have to fund.
Yeah, we have, I think we have the distinction of having the most underfunded pension system in the entire country.
Well, and a constitutional mandate to pay the bill.
Benefits be paid.
Right, the constitutional mandate is only that we pay the benefits, not that we fund the pension.
Oh, quite so.
That's the problem.
But we're now,
I mean, that
we're
is
now,
the problem.
Yes, and I suspect you know we're now at a point where we're not funding all current obligations.
Right.
We're going into income. So my point, I don't need to give a speech, but my point is there any conceivable hope that if we're going to solve one problem, we might try to solve more than one, look far enough ahead to solve the retirement problem?
I'm afraid I don't see it.
Well, no, I we have to. I mean, we're staring down. We are in the worst shape of any pension in the country. And by 2018, we will not be able to meet our payments. Now, that doesn't mean everybody runs out runs around the street in terror. I'm suggesting to you that we don't have much time to mess around. And so, yes, I think that they will have to come as decision makers to grips with that problem. They did take a step this past session by creating a two-tiered system for future employees, which was a step that was forced upon them when whoever decides, you know, the bonding houses essentially gave an ultimatum, I believe, as you read between the lines, that you'd have to do something. So when we have to do something, I think we will get that done. But I agree with you. I mean, this needs to be part of an overall package of how we deal with Medicaid, how we deal with our pensions, how we deal with unpaid bills, how we deal with program expansion, keeping spending under control. All of it needs to be done as a package so that we can get this structural deficit under control so that we can move forward if it means more revenues, that we don't simply fund future structural deficits.
I just don't see such a thoughtful, long-term package developing. I guess I see, instead of the single vote, you say, that will solve lots of problems, that there will be efforts to deal with the problems on the horizon for the next few years.
It depends on how bad things get.
Mm-hmm. I think we have we have someone back here in the back with the microphone, then we can come up and get another
Since
question.
Since right now the legislators, their votes don't really seem to matter because all the power rests with the leaders, mm-hmm. Do you see a way of that changing in the future so that when we elect our representatives, their votes will actually mean something?
I don't think it's so much a problem of structure. Myself, my own opinion is the structure. I think, you know, was said before, and somewhat I think tongue in cheek, maybe not, but when the four tops and the governor used to meet and they'd cut the deal and go back and essentially have a rubber stamp from the caucuses. Well, actually, that's not quite accurate. They really had to go back and get the approval of the caucuses, and there used to be strong appropriations committees with committee chairs and staff that was involved and members that were committed and understood the budget, were a part of the process. All of that is gone. We have weak committees. We have chairs that are not engaged. The budgeteers simply are not engaged as they were in the past. It's a very And the problem, the linchpin of it is this. It's not that the members lack the power. They have the constitutional power to do something if they choose to do so. The acquiescence is the problem, and the acquiescence in the leadership because it's so comfortable and it's good for my career. That is the problem. That is what has to change, and that's where people come into play as voters, demanding more from their members, and not simply being a witness to a severe fiscal crisis, but rather being a decision maker who actually does take his or her responsibility seriously and holds leaders' feet to the fire and gets things done. And that means strengthening their committees again, having members have to assert themselves. They have the ability. They are the ones that vote and choose the leader. They have the power. It's just that they seem to have forgotten it.
There are illustrations where legislators have risen up and smote down the legislative leadership. In 1905, the progressive does go back a while, I guess. In 1905, the progressive Republicans stripped Speaker Joe Cannon of Danville of the U.S. House of Representatives of his immense powers. I don't see the present legislators having that kind of mindset. The problem for the individual legislator is that he or she becomes marginalized if he becomes a burr under the saddle of or expresses strong independence and is, as a result, stripped of committee roles and any meaningful participation in the process. But it can be done. The rules are adopted every 2 years by the members of the legislature, the House and Senate, respectively.
Let's get another question.
Yeah, I find a little bit of this too abstract for me to absorb. So I have a slightly different question, namely, what has increased the revenues of the state? 3% per year over this long term. Where are these additional costs coming from?
The primary increased cost to the state government in recent decades has been that of the Medicaid program, which provides health care coverage for 2.5 million Illinois residents, mostly low income, but also including middle income nursing home residents, in which the state pays 50% of the cost and the federal government pays 50%. When I was a legislator, that program, part of the Great Society, and Medicare and Medicaid came along together in 65. That program was thought to be a small program that would provide care for a minimal number of persons without care otherwise, and it has grown into this huge program that now dwarfs the state spending for elementary and secondary education, for example, and it's been growing. The Medicaid costs have been growing at about 7% a year for the past 3 decades, I think, and so that's the primary driver of increased expenditures.
Right, pensions, health care, education, K-12, not higher education, though.
Just a real quick comment. Under the rubric of it's better late than never, one of the legislators who fought his caucus on behalf of the University of Illinois was Senator Winkle.
We're coming down to a point here where we have maybe about 5 minutes or so. I guess I'm interested in, with the possibility for more constructive citizen engagement, at least beyond being so angry that they would just say, well, I'll just vote for anybody but the incumbent,
or not
voting at all.
Which
I think that there are more and more people who feel so disengaged, they're not happy with their choices, they just say, well, what exactly is the point of my showing up at the polls? I mean, how do you get people to go beyond that?
I'll defer to Rick. I mean,
that is the fundamental issue.
I think leadership would be an element in all of this. Some strong man or woman who could present a vision that was both positive and somewhat conservative at the same time, that would engender the respect of the electorate. I'm thinking back again in history, and in 1968-69, we had the election of Richard Ogilvie over Sam Shapiro. Neither of them talked about the fiscal problems that the state faced, even though they knew in the election period they faced serious problems after. But I think initially there was a sense about Richard Ogilvie that he was a strong, competent kind of leader, and was given some public support for that, although he was not reelected.
You've been listening to a program that we broadcast, or that is, I should say, we recorded last week on the U of I campus at the Illini Union Bookstore. A conversation about Illinois politics with Jim Nolan. He's the last guy you heard there. Also Rick Winkle, both of them affiliated with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the U of I, and both of them the authors of the book Illinois Politics, A Citizen's Guide. It's published by the University of Illinois Press. We want to thank the folks at the bookstore for giving us the opportunity to record and present this program. Thanks to Jim Nolan and Rick Winkle. Also want to acknowledge Mike Pritchard, who did the engineering on this program. And if you would like to listen back to the show once again, you can go to our website, will.illinois.edu, and go to the Focus section.